so there's four ideas to Advent conspiracy, and we started last week with the idea of worshiping fully. And we talked last week about whether it's practicing some things intentionally, like some like new Bible reading or prayer or time of silence and meditation, or it's just a posture internally where I try to live in the moment and pay attention to the moments, or then it's out of that space responding to the world around me and saying, hey, this is a moment in this season where I feel like I'm being invited to lean in and pay attention to something here or this conversation, or I'm being invited to do something here. We invited you into all those spaces as a way of engaging with the season in a spiritual way. And so I just want to give a minute here to asking you all that. So how, maybe in the last week, did you worship fully? What did you do in the last week differently in this Advent season than you do in your normal life? And the idea of this, and the reason we do this, is maybe by saying something. I think in the last service, people said things, and I saw other people in the other side of the room going like, oh, that's a good idea. I like that, you know? So maybe we can encourage each other. So tell me, what are some ways that this first week of the Advent season that you've leaned into Advent? Yeah, good. Praying in postures. That's excellent. I like that. The phrase we use sometimes is paying attention to your body and what does my body want to do right now? There's times where my body wants to kneel. Sometimes it wants to sit. Sometimes it needs to walk, you know, and paying attention to that in my prayer life. Good. What else? Yeah. And so you're busy right now. Yeah. I had a little bit of that going on yesterday. I was busy working on some things that I'm not going to say any more about. But it's good, though, because I find myself when I'm doing that kind of thing, thinking about the people that I'm doing those for, and it's a really good space for me. As long as I don't make it too much of like, holidays get ruined by me being obsessive about doing all these things. But yeah, good. So the idea of Advent conspiracy, for those of you that are newer to this, is that we want to enter the Advent season and worship fully. We want to get what we can out of the season, to suck the marrow out of life, if you're a Dead Poets Society fan. Like that, I don't know whether that, did that come from Dylan Thomas maybe? Anyway, so the idea is to really live in it and not just let it race by. And so then the strategy, there's three things here: spend less, give more, and love all. And what we mean by each of those is, I'm going to talk about spending less in a minute, but specifically to the idea of Advent conspiracy, the idea is that we're going to choose however much money you've set aside for your Christmas budget, that I'm going to spend less. I don't feel the need to have to go out and get people gifts just to say I got you something. We showed a video last week, and you can go on our webpage and get to the video there. But so that then I replace that giving with giving of myself. I use the example of last service. Like, the thing my boys want more than me is my presence, not my presence. Did you hear what I did there? I thought it was awesome last service. So that's the idea, and we're going to talk about that more next week, about what it means to give of ourselves in the Advent season and not just give people, oh, I couldn't think of what else to give you, Dustin, so here's a candle, which he wouldn't appreciate. He'd lie to me and hug me and tell me he did, but he wouldn't. And so I choose to spend less, and I give of myself so that down here at the bottom we can love everyone, that we can do for those that really need. And so this year on... So Dustin set up this communion table, and so it's got a little globe here to remind us to love all. Oh, I didn't know that was totally detached. He's got the whole world. I pointed out to the last service that since I've come back from sabbatical, I'm a little hyper in here, and I need to calm down. What was I talking about? Oh, the last Sunday of Advent, this. Dustin put this up here because this will be our basket that we take a special offering on the fourth Sunday of Advent that comes out of this space of the money I didn't spend buying Christmas crap and that I did relational kind of gifts instead, that then we can free up those funds to give to people that really need it. And so the money that we collect on the fourth Sunday of Advent then will be used to buy all the houses in Honduras. They'll be build the buy the blocks and the tin and the wood and all the actual things that it takes to build the house down there. So that's the big meta of Advent conspiracy, and you can read about that and all those things. This morning our topic is spending less, and so I want you to turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 6. So let me say that if you're a pastor and you're speaking about topics, there's some topics that you look at and you're just like, oh no, this is that one, right? And it's not just because I'm weird about talking about money. I think that when we start talking about money, we start talking to something that's very close to us. It's like this. I'll use an analogy here. If you had coffee with a friend this week and your friend said, let me tell you some things about how you parent your kids, you would immediately put up all your defenses, right? Because how we parent our kids is a very personal, values-driven thing. For example, we have chosen in my household that we will fight battles. We will wage major wars over eating the food that's on your plate. Whether we don't care. Like, the word ew is not allowed at our table at our house. That's just really important to us as a family, all right? And I'm not kidding. I mean, poor little Maddox has spent hours sitting at that table, and the trajectory is he's going to keep sitting at that table for many hours. And as a family, that's a value to us, and we're willing to fight battles over it. I know some of you in this room, and it's not your battle. You don't care. In fact, last service, I picked on my sister. My sister was sitting over here, and she was shaking her head vigorously. It's not worth it to her. And I'm not right, and she's wrong. I mean, yeah, but I couldn't say that in the first service. It's not that one's right and one's wrong. We both grew up the same way, you know, like, but she has a different set of values. She doesn't want to fight her kids over what they eat. So my niece, Alexis, on Thanksgiving dinner, when I made this awesome dinner, ate goldfish crackers, you know, and my kids, I forced them to eat Brussels sprouts as part of the Thanksgiving thing, like, because Brussels sprouts are awesome, and we're going to start now, right? So we all have these values, and so whenever we start talking parenting, we put our defenses up very fast, because we're not just talking about parenting, we're talking about value systems. And the same is true of money. When we start talking about money with each other, it gets really dicey really fast, because we're not just talking about how dollars and cents, but rather we're talking about what's important to us. And it's very close to our identity. Somebody, I've heard people say, or preachers say for years, if you want to know somebody's value system, where do you look? You look at their checkbook, right? And that's true of all of us. We spend money on the things that are most important to us. And so some of us do that more intentionally, but we all drift that way. And so talking about money is one of those things where it's just, you know, talking about money, talking about sex, these things are really close to where people are, and we all get a little bit like, parenting, we get a little nervous. So just want to say up front, be nice to the preacher when this is all over, all right? Because I'm just trying to introduce topics, and I'm not trying to point fingers at anybody. And so we don't want to judge each other in this. We just want to have a good conversation and maybe some food for thought this morning. Let's read the text. It's in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' most famous sermon in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Matthew chapter 6, verse 19. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy and where the thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light, but if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Let me say one thing, and then I want to ask you what you all think about these verses. Those two weird verses in the middle, where it seems like he's talking about money, and then Jesus is talking about eyes, and then he's back to talking about money, seems a little strange. Well, if you go to Magadi Church, that seems like normal. He thought of something weird and went out over here, and it had nothing to do with anything else. Jesus actually is like staying in a flow of thought, that they would have seen the eyes, you know, the eyes of the window of the soul kind of idea, that there would have been that idea. And if you look at the footnotes that you have in your NIV Bible, it's actually a really good footnote, that idea about the eyes being healthy or unhealthy is a play about generosity. Somebody said in the first service, scarcity and generosity, that if you're generous, it's good. If you're scarce, like hoarding, it's bad. And so that frames this conversation a little bit about generosity and scarcity. Otherwise, what does this passage bring up in your minds? Oh, that's interesting. So to think about, like, maybe I don't feel it, but if I save up over here, if I invest in this over here, my heart will get there eventually. That's an interesting way of thinking about it. Sometimes we have to go backwards into the right way of living or thinking. Yeah. 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 There's this famous, well, it's not famous, maybe. They talk about, when you do research with the American people or any people, and you ask them about their behaviors, specifically the one where they ask people, how often do you go to church? Like, it's reported that this morning across America, like 30% of Americans are in church. Except when you go out and sit outside of churches and actually count how many people are coming out of church, it's not that many. In that we aspire to a certain kind of value, but when it actually comes to doing it, there's a gap. And this is kind of what he's talking about. There's an aspired to value, but there's always a gap for us. It's good. One or two more. Somebody in the first service was talking about her, when I asked the question about the worship fully thing, she talked about her reflection over the first week of Advent has been on how everything is temporary. And in both good and both sides of that, that the goodness in your life, we were talking about, Jennifer and I have been having a lot of conversation over the last several months at least about this time we have with our children is temporary. Like it's a season. 10 years from now, our youngest will be a senior in high school. And 10 years ago, 10 years used to seem a long time, but it's not. Like 10 years is going to go like that, and we're going to be, depends on who you ask, home alone, yes, or home alone crying. But that's temporary, and so we want to live into the goodness of that wherever we can. But there's also this other side that says pain and dark seasons are just seasons too. They're temporary, and you will get through it. And it doesn't feel like it, but you will. And so that reflection over the temporariness of both is kind of at the heart of the passage is there's temporary things and moving through those is, you know, and money being one of those very temporary situations. So whenever we start to talk about money here, there's tensions that just exist in the topic. And I want to acknowledge some of those and we're going to do some of this together. And the first one is that we make assumptions about wealth as Americans. I have this quote that I came across this week in my office door up on the whiteboard. And the quote was, and maybe you all have heard this before, but fish are the last to discover water, right? That if you're a fish, water is just the air you breathe, but that doesn't, that's, no. Water is just the water you breathe, and you don't even notice your context because it's all you know. And there's, whenever we start talking about wealth, we all live in a context, and that context is the richest civilization in the history of the world by a lot. And so there's assumptions that we have about money that just come part of what it means to be an American. So I just want to open it up. This isn't about you. This is about what your friends think. That's fine. But tell me, what are the assumptions that we carry into this room as Americans about wealth? The more money you make, the more valuable we are. Yeah? Time is money. Yeah. I'm valuable if I have. Yeah. It's attainable to anyone. Yeah. I'm going to come back to that in a little bit. But there's not enough for everyone. Right. But you can get it with plastic. Good. What else? We have a right to more money. Good. If you just work hard enough. How about this one? I think there's an assumption in our culture that wealth equals virtue. That if I have wealth, I think this comes from a Christian idea too, a little bit, that there's this idea that if I have wealth, it's from God, and therefore there's virtue tied up in wealth. And there's studies that show this, like if you go into a store dressed one way versus another way, you get different kinds of service, that there's an assumption that if you have money, you wouldn't steal from us. And there's an assumption if you don't. I would say also, somebody asked me this after the first service, I think this is true. I think there's a growing trend in our culture then to demonize the rich as well. That there's both things going on. That there's some places where we assume that because people have money, they're virtuous. And also, we assume that if people have money, they lack virtue. And you want to hear a little like, can I do a little tangent? This is my not pastor hat, but American hat. The tangent is this. So what's I think happening in the American context is that as you have the growing gap between the rich and the poor, and as the people, look at me, getting all ramped up. Sorry. And as the people feel like the rich are controlling the political climate, then the voice of the people comes through the arts. And I was listening to this thing on NPR that was talking about how if you look at movies and who the bad guy is in movies over the last 10 years, who's the bad guy in many, many, many movies now? It's a white, wealthy businessman, right? And so the voice of the people is coming through the arts, and the voice of the wealthy is coming through the politicians. Huh, you think? That's my theory I'm trying out. I ran it by my friend. He hasn't responded. So there's all these assumptions. I just want to, this video, I just want you to watch and just kind of let it sit, and maybe we can talk briefly about it on the backside of it.
You really need this money? It doesn't look like you need this.
I don't need it, but it's free. I wouldn't take it.
Oh, okay.
Hey. Christ.
Hey, is it really cool? Yeah, if you need it. You have a Louis Vuitton bag. You really need this?
Yeah, I have a nail appointment tomorrow.
So where were we at? Where?
Here's a dude walking around.
I don't even need it.
See? You don't need it, but you're taking it? Is that a real Givenchy bag?
Yeah.
Oh, help yourself. Good. Doing good. How are you?
Pretty good. What's
good? Good.
This?
Take whatever you want.
I'll just grab two. Only here. Put that back.
Oh, it's okay.
And then.
There you go. Is that all you need?
Yeah, that's it. I just need two. I'm just trying to get some food and just give whatever you gotta give to other people.
You don't want to take any food to any for more for tomorrow or anything or the next
day? No, I'll be good, dude. Just give it to other people.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate that. You're an amazing guy. I wanna make sure that you eat.
No.
I'm not gonna let you not eat tomorrow or the next day. That's an amazing thing that what you just did, right? Just wanna give you here's like $60 or whatever, and you should be able to get food for your dog and for whoever you need during the whole week. See you later. I appreciate it. Take care, guys.
Thank you so much.
So that kind of gets at some of our assumptions, right? That we just assume that, you know, there's virtue, and the virtue doesn't matter necessarily as we work with people. I think the other side of this, by the way, is sometimes we assume that there's virtue in being poor. You know, like, depends on where we're at. We kind of just, it's a long, long thing, though. The question then I have is, the tension then is that we have assumptions about what it means as Americans. The tension there is then what assumptions does the Bible make about money? We could do probably a long series about assumptions the Bible makes about money. I'll point this one from Jesus and then another one from Jesus where he talks about it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter into heaven, and say that at least in the Bible it's not so clear that wealth equals God's blessing, but rather that wealth is a mixed bag. Can we at least say that wealth is a mixed bag? I said in the first service, like, I have this idea I'm playing with, and I won't commit to it yet, but that maybe at some level that wealth is actually detrimental to our souls. That maybe we see wealth as a blessing. What if it's just the opposite? What if it's Trojan horse, right? Like, what if it's just the opposite? That what we see is, oh, if I just get this, I'll be happier. But actually, the truth is, somebody in the first service quoted Notorious B.I.G., more money, more problems. And maybe that's the reality, because that's who we quote every week at church, right? So that's one of the tensions I think we have, is as Americans especially, richest country in the history of the world, there's tensions we have culturally that we think about money in a certain way, and I think the Bible is calling us to think differently, and so that creates a tension in us a lot. And then secondly, the tension is related to what I was saying earlier, is that this is really a core issue to us. I tell people all the time when I'm doing premarital counseling that marriage, I know not all of you are married, but if you choose to be married someday and you get married, I realize that maybe it's not just your choice, if you're married someday, that marriage is one of the crucibles upon which you will be formed in the image of Christ. That in marriage, you will, I hate to like break it to you, but there will come a point where you're going to have to forgive this person that you love so much. That will happen as soon as you meet them, right? Like, it'll happen very quickly. And then on the other side of this, newsflash, you're going to have to apologize sometime or another, right? And so those dynamics of being in that kind of relationship, I will say that in my own life, I am more formed in the image of Christ because of my interactions in my marriage than anywhere else. That's the big one. And they say then that money is the one of the leading causes of divorce. And it's because money gets so core to who we are and our value systems, what I said earlier. And so this becomes a really, really core issue when we start talking then spirituality and what does it mean to follow after Jesus. Our attitudes and our practices about money become essential to our conversation about what it means to follow after Jesus. I don't think we can have meaningful conversation about how do I follow after Jesus before it gets rather quickly to, and how do I prioritize my spending? How do I live in the world? And what will I do and what will I don't do because I follow after Jesus? I've been working in my head. So if that's true, if at least in the Bible, wealth is ambiguous and thorny, I was really stumped this week for a while. I was asking myself about the spiritual risks of wealth. Because I think that as an American, I've bought so long into this idea that if I have wealth, it'll be good. And it'll, like, life will be easier if I'm wealthy. And I think that even if we say the church answer, no, I don't believe that, there's something in the water that we just, at least I do. It's really easy to drift back into that. And so I was trying, and this is probably the beginning of a list. And if you all have more ideas, I would love to hear them. But I was thinking about what are the spiritual risks of wealth? What does wealth do in us that's detrimental to our souls? And just a couple of first ideas. One is that I think it numbs us to our own need. That wealth affords us the opportunity to not need anything. I don't have to get to a spot. Oh, that was first service. Somebody was talking about being needy. Like, it's good. I think it's good for our souls when we say to the people around us, I need you right now. And then at another level, to recognize that even in those darkest nights of our souls, our friends can't fill up what we need. And then to say even to God, I can't get by without something from you. So wealth numbs us to that. You know, at the very top level, like, you know, we think about numbing behaviors of like alcohol or whatever, but even all kinds of other behaviors, shopping or eating or whatever those things are that keep our needs at bay, that wealth tempts us to not address our real needs because we can buy the things that numb us. I think also then kind of related to that is this idea that wealth isolates us from other people. Wealth has a way of keeping us from really entering in with other people. And I'll do the big macro at this. I think it's true in individual relationships, but the big one is that it keeps us from knowing what it's like to be the other. If you listen to our political conversations, both on the right and the left, it's rich people talking about the problems of poor people, right? And oftentimes, if you follow political discourse, you get these moments where like they just don't get it. They just don't understand what's happening here. Like they don't know what it's like to not know how we're going to pay for dinner next week or have to make hard decisions. Like, yeah, we can do that, but I can't do that even though I really want to do that. And wealth isolates us from those. And so then we can get on our moral high horse and say platitudes like, well, if you just work harder. Well, we met this woman. I've told this story so many times here. We met this woman in the first couple years of our church. We were working down at River West and she was going to school. She was going to school to be a beautician, to do hair. And we asked her what she wanted to do with her life, and she told us she wanted to go into nursing. It seems like she's going to the wrong school, right? Except not that she had to get her GED. I think she was pregnant in high school. She had to get her GED, and now she was working so that she could go cut hair. And the purpose of cutting hair was it was something that would be easy to get, that she could go and learn and do and start saving money so that she could go to nursing school. And maybe if everything goes just right, maybe by the time she's 40, she'll actually get to do the thing that she wanted to do in her life. Meanwhile, most of our kids in this room will graduate high school and we'll say, what do you want to do with your life? And we'll find a pathway that our kids get to do exactly what they do by 25. And then we say the American story is that it's a level playing field. Everybody has opportunities. It is not a level playing field. We do not have the same opportunities. But if you're isolated from others, you don't even know what it's like for everybody else. That preaches. Sorry, I was getting a little sweaty. Wealth has that way of isolating us from others. And I don't want to say that all wealthy people are isolated. I know people that do everything in their power to try to break down those barriers. And they read and they put themselves in situations where they're with people. It can be done. But the temptation to our souls is to keep us isolated from other people. And then finally, just one other idea about the spiritual danger of wealth is that it isolates us from the truth. And I would add power to this as well, that somehow being wealthy and powerful, people don't say the truth to us. There's a way that I know, you know, even I'm like this powerful, but even as pastor of the church, sometimes I want to make sure that my staff feels that they have the freedom to say, hey, here's the truth. And the temptation is to not say the truth to your boss, right? Everybody, like, because he has the power or she has the power, the temptation is not to. And so I think there's something there about our souls that it isolates us, or it can isolate us from truth. There may be others that are going through your head. I'd love to hear those, because I'm just kind of processing that if wealth is dangerous to our souls, as I think Jesus believes, or at least poses a challenge, then I would like to get at the why. Here's the number. I know that what's happened in this room so far is that some of you have felt like I've been stepping on your toes, or I've been looking at you too much or more than I usually do. Not true. trying to look at everybody equally. And then some of us in this room, we've been pointing fingers this whole time, right? We've been thinking about somebody in our family, or maybe somebody in the room, or somebody we know. And we've been like, I hope they hear this. Like, hope they're getting the message here about wealth. That's the median American household income. Most of us at Imago Dei Church are above that. Most of us at this church, not everyone, but most of us in this church, and if we aren't, many of us are just young in our careers and we'll get there. Most of us are in the top half, at least, of the richest country in the history of the world. Almost every single one of us in this room has discretionary income. Almost every single one of us could have bought Coldplay CD this week if we really wanted it. Almost every, it would not have been an issue for most of us. And so this conversation about wealth is, Dustin was really big when he and I were talking about this week. He's like, this is something we all face. This isn't a message for the rich and it's not for the poor. This topic is probably one that strikes every single one of us more than any, hear what I'm saying, any other topic I could talk about, even though the ones you really want me to talk about. This one's more important for us to hear because all of us have to deal with it in our own souls. It's not just ideas that we have out there about the world. Hear me? Like, is that, like, this is, it's for all of us. And so the invitation in the Advent conspiracy is that we ask these kinds of questions. That part of what it means to follow after Jesus is that we're asking each other these kinds of questions about what is God doing in me, and what is God asking of me, and what does it mean to be generous, and what does it mean to treat resources as scarce, and how do I go about living in the world? What does it mean for me to spend less at Christmas so that I can give more of myself and I can love the world? Like, how do I do that? And that's the invitation of Advent. Let me just do one last thing and then I'll pray. But I think when we start talking about peace, so the liturgical calendar, the candle we did this morning was for peace. Obviously, there's big issues about peace in the world we could talk about, right? There's huge issues. But in terms of even at the level of inner peace, I think if we stay on the rat race hamster wheel of our culture that says you need more, you need more, you need more, your value is tied up in what you get, there will never be any peace in us. Our culture specializes in keeping us not at peace when it comes to these kinds of things. And so the spiritual challenge then is to engage in these discussions. How do I get off the hamster wheel? How do I not see that as the thing I'm chasing after, but chasing after things that actually last and things that matter, where moth and vermin and rust do not destroy? Let's pray. God, be with us in this. Help us to be people that have these kinds of conversations gracefully and lovingly, and yet also I want to be somebody that in my circles, in my intimate circles, that we lay everything out there and we engage in all the discussions, and I'm not holding back and cordoning off parts of my life and saying this part isn't spiritual, but God, rather lead us into places where we're being formed and we're becoming more like you, even in the way that we spend or don't spend. God, thank you for what's going to happen the rest of this day. Thank you for the people who are giving generously of their time and giving generously of their funds so that this can happen this afternoon. In your name I pray. Amen.